From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, investigative reporter Cheryl Jones joins us, followed by Open Lines with special guest Lynn Kitai of the Phoenix Lights fame, coming up on 25 years since the Phoenix Lights. Seems like just yesterday Art Bell was talking about it. My gosh. Here's what's happening. Ukrainian forces battling Russian invaders on all three sides now after Moscow unleashed the biggest attack on a European state since World War II, prompting tens of thousands of people to flee their homes. It is morning time there now, and bombs away. After Russian President Vladimir Putin declared war in a pre-dawn televised address, explosions and gunfire heard throughout the day in Ukraine's capital and elsewhere in the country. Russian troops are 20 miles away from Kyiv, the capital. Ukrainian President Zelensky said that, according to preliminary figures, at least 137 Ukrainian soldiers had been killed since the Russian invasion, and 316 soldiers wounded. That number will go way, way up. Vladimir Putin, by the way, has appeared to threaten nuke strikes if any country tried to attack Russia. In retaliation, in a very terrifying speech, he said the consequences of any attempt to strike back following the country's invasion of Ukraine would provoke a response never seen in history. In an address to the United Kingdom, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that diplomatically, politically, economically, and eventually militarily, this hideous and barbaric venture of Vladimir Putin must end in failure. Plummeting COVID-19 case counts across the United States are leading to lifted mask mandates and more conversations about steps towards normalcy, but more people are dying of the coronavirus now than during most points of the pandemic. More than 2,000 COVID-19 deaths have been reported in the United States every day for the past month. Daily death rates are falling, but from a very high point. Let's check in with Christian Weil from MyHeartBook.com. Christian, what do you have for us this week?
Well, no doubt, George, we all want the best for our families.
Yes.
So inasmuch as the country of Denmark has already transitioned well into their experiment of dropping all mandates and mask requirements, so would the question would be, would the U.S. be wise to keep an eye on that country's progress a while longer before putting our families at undue risk, particularly since WebMD has already reported the following advice. COVID rates jump after Denmark lifts all restrictions. Jeez. That's not all, George. The New York Times has also posted this morning, Denmark, overflowing with virus cases, embraces a bring-it-on attitude. So, question being, would waiting and watching a short two or three more weeks be the safest approach for America? There is some more recent news, George, to add to tonight's report, and that is that eight other countries besides Denmark are adopting the same approach and lifting restrictions to where they were prior to the pandemic because of having attained the high vaccination rates and low viral cases, as was the goal from the outset of this crazy outbreak. In other words, now that we have complied with the demands of vaccinations and boosters, enough already. Eight of those countries just happen to be Spain, France, Greece, Belgium, Canada, the UK, Africa, and Italy, and soon to follow, the United States.
Are we at a point where now, Christian, where we just have to learn how to live with COVID?
I think you're right.
Yeah, me too. Thanks. We'll talk to you next week. More details are coming to light about Bob Saget's death as investigators in Florida have theorized what might have happened in his final hours. The Full House alum died from head trauma. Now, that's a statement from Saget's family in the Orange County Medical Examiner's Office previously revealed. The comedian was found dead in his Orlando hotel room at the Ritz-Carlton on January 9th, just hours after posting on Twitter about a show he had performed in Jacksonville. Authorities confirmed that no foul play was suspected. Per the statement, citing authorities, Saget accidentally hit the back of his head on something, thought nothing of it, and went to sleep and never woke up. The statement said there were no drugs or alcohol involved. Saget was found dead in that Florida hotel room, and investigators are now theorizing that Saget lost consciousness in the bathroom of his hotel room, fell backward onto the marble floor, striking his head. After that, authorities believe Saget regained consciousness, got into bed, where he again lost consciousness and ultimately died. Wow. Could your pet help prevent the onset of dementia? A new study reveals having a furry little friend in your life for more than 5 years can slow cognitive decline in older adults. How about that? A recently discovered repeating fast radio burst is deepening the mystery of these already deeply mysterious space signals, whatever they are. Astronomers have tracked its location to a galaxy almost 12 million light years away, which makes it the closest known extragalactic fast radio burst, 40 times closer than the next closest signal. But what are they? What's going on in the skies? Let's check in with Kevin Randall. Kevin, what do you have for us this week, sir?
Hey, George, how's it going?
Good.
Well, the one thing that we all look for is some kind of repeatability. That means simply that people in other locations and at other times report a craft that is similar. One of the problems in the UFO field is that a wide variety of craft that are reported, with very few cases in which similar craft is seen somewhere else at the same time. Fran Ridge of the NICAP website and the MADAR program alerted me to a sighting that has some of this repeatability properties I talked about. He wrote about a sighting he sent to the National UFO Reporting Center. On September 3, 2021, he and 14 others were in the Poconos when they watched a lighted object for about 5 minutes. According to his report, they were doing what he termed as a sky watch event in Bloomington Grove, Pennsylvania. At 9:44 p.m., two of them saw three lights moving slowly away from them around the Sterling, Pennsylvania area, heading towards Scranton. They used high-powered binoculars to watch the craft. To the unaided eye, there were three yellowish-pinkish lights in a row. They reminded Fran Ridge of mercury vapor lights. They were about the size of a pencil eraser seen at the distance. The lights were arranged in a horizontal pattern. When they looked through the binoculars, they began to suspect that they might be seeing the back of a craft that was very large. It moved very slowly, and they watched for about 5 minutes until they lost sight of it behind a tree line. They said it was too slow to be an airplane. What Fran found particularly odd, you know, sometimes I have to practice these things.
Say that 10 times, would you, Kev?
Oh, my goodness gracious. Well, what Fran found particularly odd was that through the binoculars, he could see that under the three yellowish lights, there were three tiny red lights that blinked randomly and not sequentially. One would blink once, and then a second later, another would blink. They thought they might be looking at the back of a large black triangle. He also noted that they didn't take a photo of the UFO. That was one sighting of a craft with a specific set of lights. The MUFON case management system had a report from December 14th of 2021 from a witness in West Dundee, Illinois, who saw an object that Fran believed was similar to the one that he had seen in September. Although there wasn't a photograph, the drawing submitted by the witness looked like the object Fran and others had seen. There were two additional sightings in Illinois, and all three took place in December within a day or two of each other. All three were of a triangular-shaped object. Importantly, in the case of the Macomb, Illinois, the witness made a video with his cell phone. Fran posted a photograph of an object taken on the night of January 31st, 2008 in Indiana. This, too, reminded him of the object he had seen, and it seemed to be related to the Illinois sightings as well. And I'll post a copy of the Indiana photograph to my blog. In all the cases reported here, the object had a line of lights on what appeared to be the rear, and in all cases, it seemed that the UFO was triangular shaped. This does suggest that note of repeatability that I mentioned earlier. I'll say here that the December sightings in Illinois are part of the MUFON case management system and are still under investigation, and if I find out more information about them, I'll post it to my blog. And that's what I got for tonight, George.
And, Kev, let me ask you this. As a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, you served in Vietnam, you were in Iraq. What do you think Putin is up to?
I thought originally that he was just pulling a Hitler. If you remember, in 1938, Hitler invaded the Sudetenland, which was part of Czechoslovakia.
Czechoslovakia, that's right.
And he said, well, it's because I'm protecting the German citizens in this area, which was historically part of Germany. And, of course, later on, he took all of Czechoslovakia. I don't understand why nobody has pointed that out, that this is kind of out of Hitler's playbook. He declared these two areas in Ukraine as having a lot of Russian citizens who were maybe in danger or under some kind of hostile threat. So he was moving in to protect them. But the invasion is into the whole country. The thing that bothered me, apparently he sent 75,000 troops in, and the Ukrainian army is at 250,000. And the standard doctrine in something like that is when you attack, you want a 3-to-1 advantage, and they're outnumbered by 3-to-1. So I don't understand the strategy there or what they're doing. I just don't know what his ultimate goal is. I can't believe that he thinks he's going to get away with taking all of Ukraine, but there might be some kind of compromise that gives him parts of it.
We'll watch it. Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate everything you do for us. And in a moment later tonight, Cheryl Jones, our investigative reporter, talks about the Phoenix Lights with Lynn Kitai. So make sure you're part of the program. Then in our final hour, Lynn will stay with me and Cheryl taking your calls. In a moment, Art Rosengarten joins us. We're going to talk about tarot cards. And then next hour, he will do readings with you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Dr. Art Rosengarten back with us. Full-time Jungian psychologist in California. Has been doing psychotherapy for more than 45 years with a wide range of patients. He's also a master of the tarot cards. Wrote his first doctoral dissertation on tarot card reading back in 1985, has been teaching, lecturing, writing about, and reading people's cards for more than four decades. A couple of his books include Tarot of the Future, Tarot in Psychology, and his website, moonlightcounseling.com, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Next hour, we will do readings with the tarot cards. I'll tell you about that a little bit later on. Art, welcome back, my friend.
Hi, George. How are you?
I'm great. There are a lot of things I want to talk with you about, the tarot, how you got involved in it, but I want you to do one thing for us right now, if you can.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you a question about what's happening in Ukraine with Russia.
Yeah.
I want you to pull the cards and just tell us what you think.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes, I will.
All right. The question is, of course, will this situation between Russia and Ukraine continue to fester and get out of control?
Okay, so I'm spreading out my cards right now on my table in front of me, George, and they're all shuffled up, face down. I'm going to, you want me to pick one card?
One card.
One card.
One card and give us your best.
I'll tell you what the tarot card says. Okay, so what we have here is a card that's called the Seven of Wands, and it's reversed. It's upside down. Now, it means stalemate. It means it's a picture of a young man with six kind of stalks in front of him, or wands, and then the seventh one he's holding across his chest sideways, and it's normally a position of kind of digging in for a long battle. But because it's reversed, it would suggest to me that there's going to be difficulty in staying with this. Right now, it's very dramatic, and there's all kinds of things happening. But it's going to start wearing on us, on the world, much more, and I think it's probably the conditions are going to get much more difficult, and our resolve is going to be more shaky with it. That's what it says to me.
That doesn't sound too positive, Art.
Well, it's not a very positive situation, George.
No, not at all. Okay,
yeah.
We're going to continue monitoring this.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in tarot card reading as a clinical psychologist?
Actually, in a weekend workshop in graduate school, I was studying Jungian psychology and Eastern philosophy, and a professor of mine who was an Indian philosopher also was a tarotist and gave this weekend workshop on the cards, and I thought that was fascinating, and I could see how it could be adapted to clinical work in psychotherapy. The images were just so compelling, and they seemed to just capture psychological experience if you know how to work with symbols and intuition. And so I just I loved it, and I stayed with it, and ended up writing my doctoral dissertation comparing tarot readings with dream analysis and projective storytelling, like the Rorschach or TAT in this case. And I haven't really looked back. It's kind of a second thing I do. I'm primarily a practicing psychologist. Right. You know, I see some 30 to 40 patients a week, and I've been doing it for a long time. But I also teach the tarot, and with some patients at certain times, I will suggest that we try a reading because we've kind of reached an impasse, or we want to go deeper, but we're not exactly sure where to take it. And most patients are very open to it as an experiment, and patients usually say tarot shows the bigger picture.
So they don't say my psychologist is way out there.
No, some of them do. I don't offer it to those that are likely to say that. But you know, there's many people that are no experience. They think it's a little weird, but they like me, and they say, okay, I'll give it a try. And I would say almost always they come away with minimally saying, that was really interesting. That actually, I did get some stuff from that. It was very interesting.
You were first with me on our St. Louis show, The Nighthawk, back
yes,
in 1996, I believe.
Yeah.
So we're on 26 years, Art. Can you believe that?
It's very sad, George. Very sad. You know, and you're quite a bit older than I am. I think about 2 or 3 months.
Exactly.
But yeah, we've been doing this kind of stuff for a long time, George.
If we multiply 26 times how many appearances you've made on all our shows times how many people you've done readings for, it's got to be in the thousands.
Oh, probably in the tens of thousands. I mean, in my entire career, not just on this show, but I've done a lot of readings.
When you're doing this for your clinical patients, do they pick the cards or do you?
They pick the cards. I'll tell you my thoughts on it, because now most of my patients I see over Zoom, and I have developed a method where they can actually pick them through me by my running my hand over them.
And they tell you to stop or something, right?
They say stop, right.
Yeah.
But, no, I think it's better to have them pick the cards. It really does not matter, in my opinion. But when a person picks the cards, they take more ownership of the reading. And they don't turn around and say, hey, yeah, but you picked the cards.
Well, when we do calls next hour, you pick the cards.
I will pick the cards. I will ask the callers to, you know, empower me to do that. The cards are always shuffled exhaustively, cut, and then fanned face down. And I use my own kind of intuition just to pull very quickly. I turn the cards over, and if they ask a question, I go very directly, this card is saying this, this one is saying this, and this one's saying that, in three preset positions. That gives it a little structure. So the reading that I like to do on the show is the first card, whatever the question is, I'll say the first card represents how it looks to you or how it appears, and I'll turn it. And I'll just read the card. Then the second card will represent what's really going on. So not the way it appears, but what's really going on. And then I'll pull the next card, and I'll read that card. And then finally, the third position will say, what I need now, what I need to think of, what I need to focus, what I need to do now. And I'll pull the third card, and I'll simply read that card as I always read that card, and maybe try to make sense of it if the caller is not quite clear on what it's about, and I'll let them take it, and they, you know, if they can take it, and if it speaks to them, great. If it doesn't, hey, it's just a tarot card.
You got it. Art, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. You and I will talk more about the tarot next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, Art Rosengarten with us. Art, how do the cards work? What's behind their success?
Well, very simply, they're oracles, and this is what oracles do. And to understand what an oracle does psychologically, oracles do three things. They translate a problem or a question into an image language like that of dreams. That's one thing they do. The oracles also mirror the unconscious forces shaping any given moment or situation. The unseen, they pull that out into awareness. And then finally, they reveal that in every symptom, conflict, or problem, there's an inner spirit trying to communicate to you. So that, I mean, oracles have been around for at least 5,000 years, and many different oracles. The oldest oracle to exist into, you know, the modern age is the Chinese Yi Jing, or I Ching.
Mm-hmm.
Tarot is a Western Renaissance-based oracle. And but the thing that makes it so unique is it works with images, pictures, and very, very complex pictures, in that they're filled with all kinds of layers of meaning. And images are the language of intuition. So tarot cards and all oracles really stimulate intuition, and they open up that way of looking. And finally, intuition really shows us possibilities in the present. They open up new possibilities in the present situation that we haven't otherwise considered.
Art, when you pulled the death card or the devil card or any of these other heinous-looking cards, is that bad news?
No. You know, you've asked me this many, many times, and you know my answer.
Yes.
Like, you usually ask me, what does it mean if I get the death card? And I always tell you the same thing, George. It means you're going to die.
And, of course, you always say that facetiously.
I do, because we're all going to die eventually, and we just don't, it doesn't say when you're going to die or how you're going to die, but it is the death archetype. It's a part of life. And so when you pull the death card, you are there. You have an opportunity to consider the whole spectrum of meanings associated with death and dying. Now, the death card in tarot is often interpreted as dissolution, transformation, metamorphosis, but also we can't rule out, you know, physical, you know, death and dying,
right?
Is all included within the spectrum of that particular archetype.
But that doesn't mean you get the card run and hide or panic or anything like that.
No. In fact, it's a really great card, because it most often in a reading means it's kind of the end of a cycle. The death, it's like an ego death, you could say. It's you know, out with the old, But in tarot cards, traditionally, there's always in the death card a rising sun in the background, meaning kind of death rebirth. You know, there's out with the old, and it's really about the, you know, the loss part, but there's always a new beginning arising in the card. So it opens up both those, both sides of that, you know, archetype, as I would say.
Does it also mean it could be the death of a relationship, the death of a job, or something
Absolutely.
Like that?
Absolutely. It could be the death of a, you know, the death of living in a particular community and moving somewhere new, or it could be the death of, you know, being a parent of kids still in the house when your kids leave and go away to college. That's experienced as a kind of death, you could say.
Absolutely. Since you've been doing this for a long, long time.
Yes.
What has been for you the most impactful thing with the tarot cards?
Well, the tarot cards goes under, you know, there's three levels, you could say. You know, there's our ordinary everyday situation level, and then there's the collective level, which is, you know, kind of an invisible scaffolding of what we're all feeling in the culture based on, you know, the economy and what's happening in the world and, you know, what's happening in our age, et cetera. And then the underneath that, there's a third level, which we might call the deep self. And the tarot goes under those first two levels and brings out your connection with the deep self, where you connect with what you feel to be true in your heart. That's the level that tarot really works. And it's extremely positive and spiritually based. It seems like every tarot reading comes out with the conclusion that you need to get more into your spiritual self. And that's you know, there's all these misconceptions about the tarot, and tarot has brought that on itself, and there, a lot of hoopla and a lot of, you know, there's frauds and fakes and all that. But the actually the art of tarot is a really deep, beautiful, brilliant thing, I think.
How far back do they go?
Well, the first known cards were discovered in Europe in the late 1300s, but their origin is up for debate. Some speculate that they could originate all the way back to ancient Egypt or China. Some theorize India. Some theorize extraterrestrial origins. But my own thought on that is that the tarot, the first designer of tarot is the human imagination, that they emerge from human consciousness, and they are kind of the blueprints of the, you know, what Jung called the collective unconscious, and they're universal, and the images can vary, but the meaning behind them are kind of the core universal parts that all human beings possess, and it gets you into kind of the universal human experience.
Art, what happens if somebody gets to or hires a bad tarot card reader or interpreter?
Yeah.
That happens, doesn't it?
Oh, it certainly does happen. It's something that, you know, troubles me. And see, I don't use tarot divination for predicting the future. Sometimes the reading just calls for it because it's so obvious that it's pointing to the future. But I view a reading as a deep examination of your present state of mind.
Explain that.
What's that?
Explain that.
Well, I don't really believe there is a future as we think of it. The future is a concept, is a construct. The future always emerges as a part of the present moment. It's part of the now. It's all happening now. The future is an idea. It's an important idea, but it's happening in this moment, and it's very changing. We tend to think of the future as existing in some time dimension ahead of ourselves that we can't know. But the future is accessible in the present moment. It's how we view our unfolding, how we view where we're going or where we fear to go. But that's all occurring in the present moment.
If you have a tarot reader who's very enlightened, psychically inclined, does that make it even better?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Because not only if they are, but if you're reading tarot cards for very advanced people, and I've read at Buddhist retreat centers with some very high meditators, and they've come to me for readings, and they just get it immediately. I don't even have to say anything. You know, I'll present what the card is, and I'll show them, and they'll just smile and nod. You don't even need any words because it's so, apparent. It's so obvious.
You've written how many books on tarot now? Four, right?
Four, probably, and a couple of workbooks, but yeah, four. One is my deck, which I created myself out of Sandplay Therapy. It's a very unique deck where I added a few cards to the major arcana, and it's called Tarot of the Nine Paths, which is also available on Amazon, by the way. And my book, Tarot of the Future, is a deep philosophical look at the emerging themes of our time, and really it's all about the meaning of time and as opposed to the experience of time.
What has been one of the strangest readings you ever done, Art?
Oh, my God.
And I'm sure there have been a lot.
Well, I don't know if it was the strangest. One that I thought was kind of amusing, that comes up for me, is I was reading at a big party in Palm Springs where they hired a bunch of readers, and we all had our own private little tents, and this was a black tie affair. We had all these wealthy, sophisticated people, and a man sits down in my booth, and I give him a reading. It was a New Year's Eve reading, and so I go through a whole 10-card reading, and the final card that I turn for him, I say, and really the theme of the coming year for you will be, and I turn the Fool card, right? And the man has this kind of really goofy grin on his face when he sees that. So I felt really curious, so I said, I'm curious, what is it that you do, sir, in your work? And he said, oh, I'm a brain surgeon.
I love it.
So I thought that was amusing to me with the Fool and all of that. He's not messing with my brain, I'll tell you that.
Not you're going to say he's a comedian in Hollywood or something like that.
Right.
Have you seen, not necessarily the death card, but have you seen a crisis or controversy with an individual when you flip cards?
Oh, yes. Even on your show, the last time I was on, there was a woman who called, and it was, she was a very sweet woman. She had all kinds, an older lady, and she had all kinds of really severe medical issues, and unfortunately, I pulled the death card as the final card for her, and it was kind of apparent. I kind of talked about death as death awareness and preparation and things like that, but it was right there, and it was hard, you know, it was hard to confront, but I did confront, you know, I did, you know, like I never hedge on a card. I kind of tell it the way it is, and I just trust that people will adjust to find a way to accept it and evaluate it and look at it. And if you try to disguise a card or you soften it or something like, people will know, they can feel it intuitively that what it really is saying to them. So I said it very compassionately and gently to the person, but I didn't, you know, hedge on the fact that, you know, my feeling was that the lady was going to die soon, and so that's difficult, but it's true. So,
but you have a sensitivity about you, though, Art, don't you?
I'm an intuitive, and tarot's really helped to open my intuition. I think I'm a natural intuitive. And in my work as a therapist, I mean, I see 35 patients every week. So I've the work itself, working with people on that kind of deeper level, just opens a certain type of sensitivity, I suppose. And so all of that is just kind of a natural thing for me.
Just ahead, next hour, we're going to take tarot card readings for you. Art, what do you need from people? Just a question?
You ask a question that's important to you, and it could be a personal question, or it could be a question about any coast kind of issues that, you know, it doesn't have to be a personal, but it could be relationships or health or career generally are the big ones, or spirituality perhaps. Because this will be a very short reading, just three cards. A regular reading with me is an hour, takes an hour, and it's about 11
cards.
Yeah,
you've already got jammed phone lines. Okay, we'll come back in a moment with Art Rosengarten and take your readings next.